Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this Labor Day weekend with an analysis of where the labor movement stands and speak with Dr. Holly Shaken, who studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. We'll discuss gains made by labor in California and the upcoming open convention of the AFL-CIO. Then, in contrast to the flat and falling wages for working Americans, we'll look into the scandal of CEO pay and how corporate heads who either preside over massive failures and losses, are engaged in fraud and deception, or are bailed out by the taxpayer, the bailed out, the booted, or the busted, are rewarded. Veteran labor journalist Sam Pizzagatti joins us to discuss the new report released by the Institute for Policy Studies. He co-authored the 20th Anniversary Executive Excess Report that examines the performance of 241 corporate chief executives. Then finally, we'll speak with longtime labor and social justice activist Bill Fletcher Jr., a columnist for BlackCommentator.com and author of Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor and a New Path Towards Social Justice. We'll discuss this week's celebration of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington in the context of divorcing civil rights from economic justice and how the American right uses the success of having a black president and a black attorney general against minorities as an excuse for rolling back voting rights. And joining us now is Dr. Holly Shaken, who is a professor in the University of California, Berkeley. He studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Holly Shaken.
Very nice to be here.
And of course, on Labor Day, we often lament the decline of labor and down to something like 7% of the private workforce overall, about 11% of the workforce. But my understanding is that next week, the AFL-CIO are going to hold their first ever open convention. What will that mean?
I think we're going to see a lot of ideas at that open convention. The AFL-CIO is working very hard to reinvent itself at a critical moment. As you mentioned, the numbers are really grim for labor. I think virtually everyone in the labor movement is aware of that. Labor nationally in the U.S. lost 400,000 members last year. It's down to about 11.3% of the workforce overall, 6.6% in the private workforce. So labor is making a real effort to introduce a lot of new approaches to really reinvent itself for the period in which we're in. And I think we're going to see some important signs of that at the AFL-CIO convention in Los Angeles, beginning with the fact that it's an open convention.
Well, in terms of the public, it's very clear that the Republican Party and their corporate backers don't like labor. That goes without saying. But a recent Pew poll says that 51% of Americans hold favorable views of labor unions. And that's happening, I think, in spite of an enormous vilification of labor that has taken place by the well-funded opponents of labor.
There's been really an unprecedented onslaught against labor, again, seeking to portray labor as a special interest, a very narrow special interest, and truly to demonize it for any economic problems that we faced as a society. But the fact that the Pew poll shows that over half of Americans polled really do have a favorable impression of labor, even under these circumstances, is, I think, a real tribute of what labor has done historically, but also that unions play a real role. So even if you're not a union member, for whatever reason, there's a sense that unions do represent broader worker interest and the broader interest of the disadvantaged, the vulnerable, the marginalized in a society.
And, of course, here in the state of California, again, California is bucking the national trend. Union membership in California has increased by 110,000 in 2012, while it fell by 368,000 nationwide. So what's California doing in the sense that quite often California sets national trends? Could this be a turnaround?
There's a much brighter picture in California. As you mentioned, California gained over 100,000 members last year. There's not a single explanation for this. There's very effective leadership on a statewide level. There's a number of unions in the state that have been very aggressive in organizing. There's the recovery of the state economy that's bringing people back to work, particularly public workers. So you've got all of that going on, but one key dimension of it is unions have reached out to the immigrant community in very innovative, very forceful ways. And that's beginning to pay real dividends. They've marched with immigrants. They've organized with immigrants. They've organized immigrants into the labor movement. And all of that positions California in a critical way with the key demographic in the state, soon to be the largest single ethnic group in the state. I think labor is paying, gaining some important dividends as a result of that.
So in terms of these bills that are being passed in the legislatures, New York and Hawaii, bills of rights for workers, particularly domestic workers, we know about the slave wages that Walmart pays and how the workers at Walmart have to use public services, the taxpayers' money, to subsidize what normally corporations would be paying for, health care and a livable wage. So is that a positive trend here?
I think it is. I think it's meant to extend labor's reach to particularly vulnerable workers. And labor is experimenting with all kinds of new approaches, including at Walmart's, where you have unions involved in groups that are seeking to protest the low wages in Walmart's and fast food restaurants, and where thousands of workers across the country have participated in short strikes to dramatize the fact that someone might be 48 years old, work 10 years somewhere at a fast food restaurant, and still makes $8 an hour. Is that the verge of unionization? Not that close today, but it's putting something on the agenda that's absolutely critical and could lead to changes down the road.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Harley Shaken, who is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. Now, in terms of these various trade deals, loosely under the heading of globalization, there's now the new Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement being negotiated now. We've had NAFTA. And there is, of course, a paradox here on the political right, where the Tea Party right wing talk about an assault on our sovereignty by UN black helicopters and the idea that there's some movement going on somewhere, some nefarious movement towards world government. So you have that mindset. But within the Republican Party, you also have this other mindset that seems to believe that global trade and relaxing rules for workers and conditions and standards is inevitable. That's just the new economic reality. I remember hearing a Republican congressman once say, it's a global world out there. So can you explain that paradox?
Well, it's certainly a very real paradox between business elements of the Republican Party that very much want to see an expansion of global trade and elements of the Republican Party that are very powerful, such as some of the Tea Party groups, that view any expansion of trade as sort of diminishing U.S. sovereignty, et cetera, and take a very xenophobic view of engaging with the rest of the world. That's something that is plaguing the Republican Party. For the Democrats, though, I think global trade, as most unions feel, can be a very positive thing. The issue becomes not expanding trade, but the rules under which it's done. And what we've seen in recent decades is expanding trade at the expense of workers rather than making working families its beneficiary. So the notion of having rules and trade agreements that guarantee intellectual property rights is widely accepted, although sometimes controversial because it pushes that too far. Rules for protecting workers' rights have been anemic at best, and the result is trade itself is hobbled because the flip side of realizing the gains of trade is expanded purchasing power, and that doesn't occur in a robust way if workers can't bargain effectively to raise their wages. So the issue isn't globalization itself, it's the rules of the game and trade agreements that diminish what workers can do rather than expand the gains for working families.
But Harley Shaken, we saw after the passage of NAFTA that the peasant farmers in Mexico basically were wiped out because there's no way that these third world countries can compete with agribusiness and the highly mechanized and chemicalized agribusiness here in the United States with enormous productive capacity and can sell, you know, grains at a fraction of what the ajito, the poor Mexican farmer on a marginal piece of land, can eke out. So how do you navigate between the power of and the productivity of corporate agriculture versus third world agriculture? Is there a balance that can be struck here? Because essentially what happened in Mexico was the entire rural poor literally marched with their feet across the border.
I think you're raising an excellent point. There's no easy answer here, but there are far better paths, and there are worse paths. With NAFTA, when NAFTA was passed, over one out of every five people in the Mexican economy earned their living on the land. Now, it's one thing to say, okay, we're going to have a transition over a period of years, and we're going to provide new opportunities in industry and other sectors of the economy for people that are displaced on the land, and quite another simply to displace people and say, well, this itself is progress. So it really requires broader and far more effective public policies and a focus on a transition that leads many people to have jobs in other areas of the economy. In Mexico, it was a transition, but for many, it was a transition into complete marginalization or immigration out of the country itself. And that didn't take into account, you know, the powerful forces of having small peasant farmers with few resources compete against large agribusiness, often heavily subsidized in the U.S. and elsewhere.
So, Harley Shaken, you mentioned Walmart, and of course Walmart's become the poster boy for anti-labor and almost slave wages. Walmart's 1.4 million domestic retail employees make an average of $8.81 per hour. And this has led even Walmart's chief financial officer to recently say that American workers simply do not have enough money to spend on the company's merchandise, and which is explaining why there has been a decline in sales. Now, that, of course, harks back to what Henry Ford said, that you have to pay your workers enough to buy your product. Have American capitalists completely forgot that idea?
I think they haven't completely forgotten that idea, but they certainly haven't put it at front and center of what this economy is going to need going forward. 70% of this economy is essentially consumption. So the flip side of low wages or declining wages is low purchasing power. So what may work very well for any single company, say Walmart, paying $8.81 an hour, is a disaster if all companies pay $8.81 an hour, because it diminishes our purchasing power, it throttles the recovery, and it results in the kind of stagnation that we've been witnessing in recent years. So the notion of putting this front and center isn't simply a question of enlightenment of corporate America. It's a question of countervailing forces that are putting it there. And historically, in this country, unions have played that role. And on this Labor Day, I think that's something very important to recognize. It isn't simply a question of union leaders or even union members, but rather that in this economy, at its peak performance, domestically and globally, we had a strong labor movement that served to link strong advances in productivity into higher wages and benefits, and into a growing economy. We've lost that linkage. We've seen productivity continue to rise. We've seen wages stagnant or declining. And the result is a drag on economic growth. And that, I think, is of great concern to all Americans, union members or not.
But surely, Ali Shaikin, there's a fundamental question here about fairness, economic fairness and opportunity versus unlimited and voracious greed. If you consider that we're talking about the people who work for Walmart, the 1.4 million people who are paid an average of $8.81 per hour, and that's less than what you pay undocumented workers here in Los Angeles to work on your garden or something, or clean your house, you know. So it's really an amazing and profound disgrace. Yet the heirs to Walmart, the children, through the accident of birth, ended up inheriting Sam Walton's fortune that's grown extraordinary to the point where the heirs to the Walmart fortune, their combined wealth is the equivalent of the combined wealth of 40% of the lower 40% of the United States, just one family. Now, I don't understand why you can't people don't make that connection. Workers not having a living wage working for Walmart, and the heirs just piling up billions and billions, which they simply can't spend. And for God knows what reason, why do they need more money? And why can't they kick back a little bit of this money and make the lives of their workers a little more livable?
Well, I think this really gets back to that core notion. Slowly over decades, by demonizing labor, by weakening the role of unions in the economy and in the society, we wound up with a situation where there isn't a countervailing force to effectively challenge this. All that said, unions still play a critical role in raising these issues, the notion of what's happened to inequality in this society. We've never been an equal society. That's not the issue. But what we're experiencing now, and you're mentioning this in the context of Walmart, is hyper inequality. And that isn't simply an abstraction. It's something that absolutely diminishes opportunity, diminishes how one's children can advance in the society, and creates real constraints that ultimately can corrode democracy itself. So these are huge issues. We didn't get here overnight, but the notion of a strong, growing labor movement being able to present a different perspective on this is very healthy, in fact, essential to the checks and balances of any democratic society.
So, Ali Shaikin, then in the last couple of minutes, in terms of good news, we started out, and my caveat, of course, in the beginning was that we normally, when we talk about labor on Labor Day, we always acknowledge the decline of labor. And now we're talking about a possible change here with the AFL-CIO's open convention this coming week. And at least the National Labor Relations Board now has all five members seated. The Republicans have basically frustrated that for years and years. And finally, that was the deal that Obama made. Will that make a difference?
I think it will. And I think leadership from the president could make an important difference. It's going to be limited in all kinds of ways, given where the Congress is on many of these issues. But just the combination of a full NLRB with people that are intent on enforcing labor law in this country and seeking to guarantee workers the right to choose or not to choose a union, I think that's going to be an important step forward. And leadership from the Oval Office could be critical. I think when we look at the reasons for some optimism in admittedly a very tough set of circumstances. The circumstances haven't changed overnight. They're not receding as a result of this Labor Day. But I think the cause for optimism we've seen on the ground in the last year or so, with a lot of very new, very innovative efforts and a sense of urgency that labor leaders feel that the current status quo is absolutely unacceptable and labor has to be turned around. The linkage of labor and social movements, Rich Trumka, the head of the AFL-CIO, has really stressed this in recent months, the notion that labor is part of a broader movement to improve American society that ranges from the Sierra Club to the NAACP to the involvement with church groups on issues such as immigration or living standards, the involvement with community groups. All that is taking place on the ground, and I think there's cause for some very cautious optimism that some of these efforts are going to take hold. Not all of them by any means, but there are things happening that are very visible, some of which that have displayed important success. And in the state of California, things could be much better for labor, but there have already been very important gains, starting with the 100,000-plus members gained last year and a percentage of the workforce of union members that begins to approach one out of every five workers in California is in a union. So you've got these kinds of developments that are out there within a context where there are still very powerful and in some cases growing forces arrayed against labor.
Well, Dr. Holly Shaken, I thank you so much for joining us here on this Labor Day weekend.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Holly Shaken, who is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. We can take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into the scandal of CEO pay.